abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, January 29th, 2014. We are talking Second Amendment today. Make sure and stay tuned after my conversation with Stephen Holbrook for a couple of announcements, including a new speaking event I have to tell you guys about. So please, please do stay tuned for that. But right now, it's my great pleasure to welcome to the program Stephen Holbrook, who, in addition to his many other credentials, is the author of numerous books on the Second Amendment, including A Right to Bear Arms, State and Federal Bills of Rights and Constitutional Guarantees, That Every Man Be Armed, The Evolution of a Constitutional Right, The Founders' Second Amendment, Origins of the Right to Bear Arms, and his most recent book is Gun Control in the Third Reich. His work has actually been cited by the Supreme Court when the court has ruled in favor of the traditional pro-gun rights understanding of the Second Amendment. So it's my great pleasure to welcome to the program right now Stephen Holbrook. Stephen Holbrook, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Well, I just got done telling people about all your books and your expertise on this subject. I can't think of anybody I would be more interested in featuring to talk about this topic that never seems to go away. I mean, when you're an expert in this topic, I would think you don't have any shortages of speaking engagements or inquiries. But I want to talk about specifically, though, the text of the Second Amendment and what it means. Now, it seems to me that maybe over the past 20 years or so, it seems like there has been a kind of a scholarly convergence on this subject, where even people who might not in their heart of hearts be super interested in the right to bear arms, nevertheless have had to admit that, well, you know what, the gun rights people more or less are correct about the Second Amendment. Am I right about this?
Yes, you are. There's an interesting history about that subject. Namely, that when the Second Amendment was adopted, the Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791. There was never any controversy about the meaning of the words. And it combines two different thoughts. It's got the Militia Clause and then the Arms Clause. And the Militia Clause states a principle of political philosophy, where regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And then the Arms Guarantee, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. That was never controversial until about the 1950s or 60s, particularly in the 1960s. And at that time, there was a big push nationwide to pass all kinds of firearms prohibitions and registration of handguns at the national level, things like that. And so the idea was invented that the people means the National Guard, and to bear arms doesn't mean to carry arms. It means to only to have them in the military. You know, one word was perverted after another, and the term right, instead of being a right of the people, it really became a right of, or a power of states to maintain militias. And then you had a number of federal courts actually adopt this nonsense. It was only in 2001, actually, the first federal appellate court, the Fifth Circuit, in a Texas case, basically held that the Second Amendment does mean what it says, and finally the Supreme Court did that in Heller in the 2008 case.
So then let's go into what exactly it does say, and I know that you take the Jeffersonian view that the Constitution and the amendments are written in a way that the average person is supposed to be able to understand it. You're not supposed to need years and years of legal training. And in fact, to the contrary, years and years of legal training seem to impair people's ability to understand the Constitution. So I think the difficulty people have is that there's a bit of a philosophical preamble to the Second Amendment. That when it talks about the militia, this, for some people, colors the whole amendment, that the whole amendment, therefore, has to do with the militia. So can you separate that for us? I mean, what is the role of the militia in the Second Amendment, and why does the presence of the militia in the Second Amendment not deny that we're talking about an individual right to bear arms?
First, let me go back to one thing you said, which was right on point, that years of legal training seemed to disqualify people from knowing what the Second Amendment meant. You had the ridiculous situation of back in, I think, about 1991, when the Bill of Rights was, bicentennial was being celebrated. There was an American Bar Association report that smugly said that more than half the American people wrongly think that the Second Amendment protects their right to possess a handgun. And so here you have these, yeah. You know.
Right.
I mean, lawyers are the only people who could say without laughing that the people doesn't mean the people.
So, I know.
So that was the original meaning. But there's no problem with having more than one thought in the amendment, just like the First Amendment covers a whole bunch of subjects. Establishment of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, assembly, and to petition the government for redress of grievances. The idea that there can be more than one thought in one of the amendments is pretty simple. So the Second Amendment combines only two instead of about six like the First Amendment. So you have well-regulated militia being declared to be necessary for the security of a free state, and that had to do with we had our bad experiences with the British Standing Army, and there was quite an aversion to these professional armies, mercenary armies, what have you. And the idea was that the militia would be, in the first instance, the true guarantor of liberty in a free state. And if you don't have a well-regulated militia, and by the way, composed of the body of the people trained to arms, that was the use of those terms in the Virginia Declaration of Rights in 1776. In fact, when Madison first proposed the Second Amendment in the House of Representatives, it didn't have that clause, but it was put in there by a House committee composed of the body of the people defining the militia, and then that was taken out to be more concise in the Senate. So everybody understood a well-regulated militia to mean the body of the people trained to arms, basically, and it didn't mean over-regulated by government. It meant that they knew how to shoot well, and they could cooperate together for mutual defense.
But today, of course, we don't live that way, right? We don't have the militia except in a trivial sense. And so somebody could, I think, argue, and they have tried to argue, that, look, the premise of the Second Amendment is that there's a tie between the right of the people to bear arms and the militia. Now, if there's no militia and we've got the National Guard or whatever you have, then doesn't this impair? In other words, how can we connect the Second Amendment to somebody who just wants a handgun for personal protection when the Second Amendment's text seems to have so much to do with a militia that doesn't seem to have anything to do with any of that?
Well, looking at it from the founders' perspective, it wouldn't have been saying something like, duck hunting being really fun, the right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. Now, granted, self-defense is more important than duck hunting. But what they thought was that by recognizing that the people have a right, the people at large have a right to keep and bear arms, that would promote a well-regulated militia. This well-regulated militia would be impossible unless the people could keep and bear arms. Anytime you would have a military force armed by the government, it can be disarmed by the government. And their thought was that we've had enough of this omnipotent government with the British that were thrown out of the colonies through the Revolution. So the whole idea was that by recognizing this right, you would have people exercising the right. They would have their own guns. They'd be ready to be called out in an emergency to overthrow tyranny, defend against invasion, defend against insurrection, all those things. So that's what the framers were thinking about. That's how they tied the two thoughts together in one amendment.
Now, we can't necessarily glean from the text of the Second Amendment everything we might want to know about it. We might have to find out what the intentions were, et cetera, of the people who ratified it. But what can we figure out based on the contemporary sources would have been considered to be the limits on people's right to bear arms? For example, were they envisioning that everybody would have the right to have the most advanced technology of the time? Like, in other words, could everybody today have a tank and then point to the Second Amendment as justification? Was there any type of limitation envisioned in the Second Amendment?
Well, I think the text of the Second Amendment itself does that. It says, keep and bear arms. Bear arms means to carry arms. And so if you're a person carrying an arm, you're not driving a tank or having a jet fighter. So I think that's inherent in the text. Now, although at the time when this was discussed, there never was any prohibition then like of an individual possessing a cannon or anything. That was fairly common in some places, in fact, where you had independent militia companies, for example. And it wasn't until the 1968 federal gun control law that things like cannons and mortars and whatnot were actually regulated federally. So you had a lot of veterans bringing all kinds of stuff back in World War II. But it never really led to any harm. At this point in history, these kinds of things are highly regulated, and nobody argues that there's a Second Amendment right to them. But at the founding, there was no regulation of that type.
Now, you've got quite a bit of material in this book, The Founder's Second Amendment, that starts off in the years before independence. So what kind of light is shed on this overall subject by studying that history and beginning there instead of just beginning with the drafting of the Second Amendment?
Well, you have to know what led to the Second Amendment, why it was considered a problem, the idea of the populace being disarmed, and also the antecedents of the Second Amendment. You start with the idea, the English Declaration of Rights of 1689 declared that Englishmen have a right to bear arms, or to have arms, rather, was the term. Blackstone talked about that right as meaning basically a right to personal defense and a right to resist oppression. So it was very well ingrained in the minds of the colonists. And then that right got stepped on by the crown, because at the same time the crown was attempting to enforce the various impositions of taxation and closing Boston Harbor and seizing merchandise, things like that. In order to enforce those things, they had to send a standing army to Boston, and they had to start taking measures to put the squeeze on gun possession and finally to try to deprive the colonists of arms. So you have things gradually happening, like a ban on importation of firearms and ammunition into the colonies. Things like, back in those days, they had large powder houses where large amounts of gunpowder were stored, and that was black powder, which was a lot more volatile in those days. So like a gun shop wouldn't have more than a few casks of black powder, and the rest would be in the public storehouse. And so General Gage, who was the head of the British forces in the Americas, made it where people couldn't get gunpowder out of these powder houses. That was called the powder alarm. And then things started happening, like militias starting to be disarmed. And you had finally the searches and seizures of people going in and out of Boston to deprive them of, to search for guns and then to take them away. And finally, all hell broke loose when the Brits sent troops to Lexington and Concord to take away the militia arms that were there, and they got beat. And not many people know what happened after that, though. General Gage, who was, as I said, he was actually governor of Massachusetts colony as well as general of the British forces, he declared that everybody in Boston had to surrender their arms if they wanted to leave town. Everybody wanted to leave town then. And so they all, on the designated day, it was a few days after Lexington and Concord, turned in their arms at Faneuil Hall, which is still there, of course. That was the meeting place of the town. And they took your name down and what you gave them, and they were supposed to give them back, and then the British soldiers came and seized them. and that was considered an act of perfidy by General Gage. So there you had the first seizure of civilian arms of people who had nothing to do even with the resistance activities at Lexington and Concord. And so, you know, from that point, it became a question of armed revolution. That was sparked in 1775. The War of Independence went underway, and basically at that point it was the rules of war applied as opposed to the normal rules of, you know, you respect others' rights to free speech and to have arms. Well, both sides were busting up each other's presses and seizing each other's arms and things like that, but that was the impetus for the Second Amendment.
You know, Stephen, when you mentioned the right of individuals to have a weapon for self-defense and so on as being a historic right of Britons, it put me in mind of an argument that says that even if we didn't have the Second Amendment, then the right to keep and bear arms would be preserved in the Ninth Amendment because it's a traditional right. And I was going to run that by you, and then as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, you know what? I think I got that argument from you years ago. Now, am I wrong? Have you ever made that claim that the Ninth Amendment basically would already contain the right to keep and bear arms because it is a traditional right?
Well, there were certainly commentators in the early 19th century who basically said that the right to self-defense is an unenumerated right, and so you could certainly make an argument that you have a right to have guns. There's never been in modern times, any court that would admit that. You have courts, of course, denying that the Second Amendment means what it says, and then also saying that the Ninth Amendment doesn't really protect anything. Unfortunately, the Ninth Amendment it has never been recognized very much by courts for anything, and it was intended that people had all kinds of rights. They were talked about during the time of the founding, and it was the idea was you couldn't put them all in paper, so let's use the language of the Ninth Amendment.
Let me ask you, how did you get interested in this issue such that you would devote so much scholarly work to this subject? I mean, were you already interested in gun rights, and then you thought, I'll check out the history? Was it that you thought that the current crop of historians or legal scholars was just all wrong? Was it a combination of these motives?
Well, when I was an undergraduate in college, a couple of things. One, I was interested in the Second Amendment anyway, and I went to the State Supreme Court Library, Florida, and found that there were no law review articles on the subject other than a couple that weren't very good and were very old. And at that time, there was a lot of discussion about it because the Federal Gun Control Act was working its way through Congress. This was in the mid to late 60s. And also I started reading the various debates on the Constitution, not just the Federalist Papers, things like that, but the debates in the state conventions where you had Patrick Henry making predictions about some things that really did come true. Virtually everything they predicted that was adverse has come true, not just on this topic. But the swarms of tax collectors throughout the country and just all kinds of things that are probably worse than they ever conceived it would be. But at any rate, there was nothing published on it. Nobody was speaking up for the right very much, and so it was something I thought was worthy of being devoted to.
Now, these days, it seems that even when you get one of these very high-profile tragedies involving a crazed shooter and innocent victims, etc., even after that, it seems that the politicians, by and large, are finding that there is just no traction they can get for gun control measures. So do you think it's safe to say that, in effect, gun control, the whole movement, is more or less dead in the United States?
Well, no, it ebbs and flows just like on any other topic. Back in the 20s and 30s, you had a big push for controls, things like proposed handgun bans, and you had a lot of prejudice against, well, this was the Jim Crow era, for example, in the era when immigrants weren't thought of as being respectable people. And so you had a lot of people fanning the flames of racism to ban guns, basically. And finally, you get some federal controls in the 30s. There were some controls at the state level. That all went away when Pearl Harbor was bombed, because then it became so irrelevant. The idea was we need as many people trained to arms as possible. I mean, banning guns is ridiculous. And so then the idea didn't come back until the 60s, and so you had a huge push and a tidal wave of gun control thought at the time and disrespect for Second Amendment rights. And, well, you know, during in the 90s when Clinton got the Brady Act passed and the so-called assault weapon ban passed, the Congress changed after that. The Republicans took over Congress. So they learned a lesson from that. Bill Clinton wrote in his memoirs that the NRA was to blame for because of this gun issue for the Democrats losing control of Congress.
I didn't know he said that. Interesting.
Yes, he did. And so I think a lot of Democrats have learned from that. And also, just generally speaking, this is not a partisan issue. It's not a Democrat-Republican thing at bottom. I mean, it's a question of you respect the rights of your constituents, and I think there's people in both parties who do, and they're just not going to pass this sort of stuff, especially knowing that it doesn't do anything for the problems that we've encountered.
Stephen, if people want to find out more about your work and your books and what you're up to, how can they find you online?
Just my website, stephenhalbrook.com, StephenHalbrook. My latest book is called Gun Control in the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and Enemies of the State. There's a lot of stuff on the website if you're interested in Second Amendment issues, and you can just Google my name and find books on Amazon or whatever. So, you know, it's a topic that's really made a lot of progress since, 20, 30 years ago. And the Supreme Court agrees with our position now. So that's really a step forward.
Well, we're very much in your debt for all the work you've done. I mean, as I said, I probably was familiar with one or two of your books, but I was not aware of just how detailed and thorough your scholarship on this subject is. It just seems completely airtight to me. So thanks so much for doing that. I mean, certainly we get recognition for our work, but sometimes the blood and sweat we pour into it is greater than the recognition. It doesn't always work out. But in your case, you really are our guy, and you've just done so much important work, and I'm so glad I had a chance to talk to you for a few minutes today. Thanks again.
Well, really glad to be on the show, Tom. Thank you.
All right, everybody, check out StephenHalbrook.com, HalBrook. Make sure also to subscribe to this program on iTunes and Stitcher, not only because every day you get great programming, interesting guests, interesting topics, more ammunition for your arsenal, but also because, remember, all the exciting interviews we did in 2013 on this program are right now in the process of being transcribed, edited, and collected into an ebook that I'm going to give to you listeners for free. But to find out how to get that ebook, you've got to listen in to the program. And what better way to do that than by subscribing so that you don't miss an episode? So while you're thinking about it right now, make sure and head on over to iTunes or Stitcher. You'll see links to subscribe in those ways at TomWoodsRadio.com. Now, I mentioned my upcoming events. I've told you guys about February 7th. I'm going to be at Washington College, Chestertown, Maryland. February 8th at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. March 1st. I'll be at the College of Southern Idaho in Twin Falls, Idaho, March 15th at the University of Central Arkansas in Conway. But also now, March 5th, I'm adding an event at Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas. Now, before you turn this off and say, well, I don't live near Topeka, Kansas, let me explain why I'm going out of my way to point out this event. It's going to take place at 5:30 p.m. We'll find out the logistical details, get them posted soon. But I feel like I'm all alone here in Kansas, right? It's very, very, very hard to find people of like mind in this area. Very hard. I can go to a lot of different places around the country and get a pretty good turnout for events. I'm not so sure I can do that in Kansas. Kansas is not woods country, unfortunately. And I'm more or less going out of my mind trying to meet people who are sort of like mind here. So if you are of like mind and you are anywhere near the Topeka area and you can possibly make it on March 5th, you would seriously warm my heart, because it would be nice to know that I'm not entirely alone out here. Finally, don't forget tonight, special event, libertyclassroom.com/live. We're having a live question and answer session with me, with Kevin Gutzman, your other favorite U.S. historian, and Brian McClanahan, All of us are authors in the Politically Incorrect Guide series of books, and I think you'll enjoy this whether or not you have a question. Just show up at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and for 90 minutes, we're going to be taking your questions. Whether or not you have a question, show up because it's a lot of fun to take part in this. You can just sit and watch, and it's much better than watching TV. So libertyclassroom.com/live tonight. And remember, you are helping me pay the bills here and keep my Tom Woods Show office where I record these programs for you guys at no cost to yourself. When you're about to make a purchase on Amazon, say to yourself, ah, gosh, isn't there something? I'm buying something on Amazon, and I remember there's some guy who keeps badgering me about this, and I think he's giving me a free show every day. Enter Amazon through our Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com, and you'll be helping us out. All right, we'll see you guys tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.